This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. In Moscow, Russian police today cracked down hard on election protesters as they chanted, "Russia will be free," in the city center. They were demonstrating against the exclusion of opposition candidates from the voting for the Moscow City Council. A group that monitors political arrests in Russia says more than 600 people, including would-be candidates, were taken into custody. Demonstrators were in the streets again today in Hong Kong, as the Chinese autonomous territory remains mired in political turmoil. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has a report.
Protesters dressed in black streamed into the Yuen Long neighborhood despite being denied official permission for the march. Police appealed to the marchers to stop, then fired tear gas as the demonstrators stood their ground. Police cited the risk of confrontations between demonstrators and local residents in barring the march. They say some of last weekend's attackers were connected to organized crime syndicates known as triads. Massive demonstrations began in Hong Kong more than a month ago over an extradition bill that have grown into a broader pro-democracy movement. I'm Ben Thomas.
Videos uploaded by journalists showed Hong Kong riot police waving batons and chasing young people wearing respirators and construction helmets into the Yuen Long rail station before it was tear gassed. A balcony collapsed overnight inside a South Korean nightclub in the town where the World Swimming Championships are being held, Gwangju. Two South Korean men are reported killed. 16 people were injured, including 8 athletes, 3 from the United States, 2 from New Zealand, and 1 each from Brazil, Italy, and the Netherlands. To stay up to date on all the day's news, we invite you online to voanews.com. There is also an easy-to-use and convenient VOA News app. From Washington, this is VOA News. The United States Supreme Court says, yes, President Trump can direct $2.5 billion appropriated for the Defense Department toward his long-promised wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The president's reaction came in a tweet, quote, "Wow, big victory on the wall." There was a hot car tragedy in New York City this weekend. A man is charged with manslaughter, saying he forgot his infant twins were in his vehicle and left them there all day. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
That father told police he went to work in the Bronx at the VA hospital and after got into his car, drove a short distance, and realized the one-year-old twins, a boy and a girl, had been in their car seats in the back all day long. Witnesses say the father was screaming for help, but it was too late. 39-year-old Juan Rodriguez is charged with manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. The organization Kids in Cars says there have been 23 deaths this year of children left in hot vehicles, including these latest two. Julie Walker, New York.
As civilian casualties mount in Syria's northwestern province of Idlib, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says she is alarmed the situation is no longer on the world's radar. Bachelet spokesman Rupert Colville says among the Syrian government's targets are health facilities, markets, and bakeries.
These are civilian objects, and it seems highly unlikely, given the persistent pattern of such attacks, that they're all being hit by accident. Intentional attacks against civilians are war crimes, and those who have ordered them or carried them out are criminally responsible for their actions.
Last year, Russia, Turkey, and Iran pledged to honor a buffer zone to protect the 3 million civilians who were trapped in Idlib. The U.S. economy hit the pause button last quarter as growth slowed a full percentage point from the quarter before. AP correspondent Sagar Magani on a developing blame game.
President Trump and top White House economist Larry Kudlow have been touting 3% growth and are blaming Fed rate hikes for slower growth.
In some sense, it's a miracle we've done as well as we've done.
But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi blames what she calls the president's tax cut scam.
It hasn't produced the revenue.
Analysts say the tax cut's benefits are largely played out. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Disaster officials say two earthquakes have shaken the Philippine province of Batanes, killing at least 8 people, injuring 60. Authorities say the 5.4 and 5.9 magnitude tremors struck early today, within hours of each other. There have been several aftershocks reported. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News, Washington.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
I have actually a Malawian that they have demonstrated their constitution, and no one, including the students, can stop for Malawians to exercise that right.
Malawian police issue a directive banning protests across the country.
It was an attempt to deflect attention from the subsequent failure by him to answer to specific things about how he had used his influence to favor his colleagues.
A former South African president threatens to reveal names of spies within the ruling party, the African National Congress, ANC.
We always ask for justice. We're still demanding justice for the killing of Dayda Haidara, state-sponsored disappearance of journalist Chief Ibrahim Amani.
And the Gambian Press Union is calling for the prosecution of former President Yahya Jammeh. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Lawyers for Human Rights Defenders Forum, a political pressure group, says it will challenge a police ban in Malawi restricting protests across the country. That directive has gone viral on the social media in recent days. Gift Trappens, the group's vice president and organizer of the protest, says the police directive contravenes the constitution. Local media reports say the police announced the ban until the organizers can ensure there will be no violence during future demonstrations. For reaction to the police ban, Rich Gift Trappens of the Human Rights Defenders Forum.
What I've been saying is that it's not the first time that we have been stopped from demonstrating. We have had state assemblies before refusing us from demonstrating. Our demonstrations have been supported by the courts because it is hard to take the court intervention for Malawians to exercise that right to demonstrate. So we are not surprised with the letter that we have received, because all along we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. So we are not amused, but as United Defenders Coalition, our lawyers are going to look into the letter, but as well we are going to respond accordingly.
But Gift, the constitution that you spoke about clearly mandates the Malawian police to enforce the laws. If your protests and demonstrations turns to violence, then they have a responsibility to ensure the country's political stability is not undermined by your actions. Don't you think so?
What we are saying is that people who can demonstrate is not only us. So to stop everyone from demonstrating, I think it's overriding our constitution. I think the responsibility of protection is upon them. They have been mandated to protect all the citizens equally. So that's why I don't want to talk more in terms of the violence, who was involved and the like, but we're going to respond that accordingly. I'm not responding to the letter because we haven't received that letter now. But I have to assure Malawians that they are to demonstrate in their constitution, and no one, including the president, can stop from Malawians to exercise that right.
You recently met former President Bakili Muluzi, who asked you to hold off your demonstrations at least for a week as he met President Atta Peter Mutharika to try to resolve this, to ensure there's peace and stability in Malawi.
In fact, we gave the opportunity for that meeting, and we met the former president. What we wanted was just to make sure that he gets our message clear. Because what we saw also in the meeting was that he was dwelling more on the demonstrations, because the demonstrations is not the root cause of the issues that we're raising. And we raised a number of issues, including corruption, nepotism, and many other issues that Malawians have been raising over time. So for us, it was not that we denied to meet him, but we gave him what Malawians want. And it's up to him to deliver that message to the authorities, maybe. And I don't think he needs more time to resolve the issue, but I think we have a government that is not listening.
What is your end game, particularly when your demand for the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission to resign has been rebuffed or rejected by the Electoral Commission, and your concerns about the electoral process or the election of President Atabuta Mutharika is being challenged in court? Why don't you wait for the process to lead to its logical conclusion and allow peace to reign in Malawi, some people are asking?
I think maybe people are asking two different questions. Actually, that question was supposed to be asked as an answer, saying why is she clinging to power or to the commission when Malawians don't want her to be in the commission? Because what we are saying is that regardless of the court decision, whether the elections were won by whoever, Malawians cannot trust the commission anymore. So we are surprised that Jenny Ansah is still clinging to power. Which elections is she going to manage? Even if you talk about the 2024 election, she's not going to manage it. I think it's a matter of ethics, the matter of professionalism, where she allowed officers to use critics. I think that's the question that we are trying to raise. Why? It's an issue of ethical, it's an issue of ethics and moral issues and professionalism. It's not, we are asking the question that is more, but what we are saying is that she's got to manage the elections better. That's why we have these cases in court. I think these are the questions that we are raising, but we're not raising who won. I think that question will be addressed by the court.
Gift Trappens is the vice president for the Human Rights Defenders Forum. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. Former South African President Jacob Zuma says he will soon reveal names of spies in the ruling party, the African National Congress, ANC. Zuma also accused Derek Hanekamp, who was his Minister of Tourism, of being a known enemy agent. Local media reports that the former president's remarks came after Julius Malema, leader of the opposition party Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, said Hanekamp lobbied his party to ensure he was ousted as president of South Africa. To learn more about the alleged conspiracy to remove Zuma from office, I reach Ongama Ntika, a political science professor at Nelson Mandela University in Port Elizabeth, South Africa.
Former President Zuma replied to say Derek Hanekamp was a known enemy agent, and that is part of the siege mentality that has captured the ANC, especially those that were in exile, who have always felt that some of their colleagues were being used by mainly foreign agencies in order to topple leaders. But the reality of the matter is that at the time that Derek Hanekamp lobbied the opposition party to topple Jacob Zuma, he had become not only a constitutional delinquent as a president, but had gone on to undermine the very governing party that had put him in the presidency and sold state power to private interests, namely the Gupta family. So at the time, in fact, there needed to be action in the higher echelons of power within the ANC. So even if now this is action that is frowned upon, it was to be expected. And in fact, what would have been national duty at the time would be to do anything in order to topple for then former President Jacob Zuma.
Derek Hanekamp has sharply denied the allegation, daring the EFF to provide evidence that proves that this is what he did. Do you think his denial is legitimate at all?
He denied having given a list of members of parliament that would vote with the EFF, but he's admitted to have met the Secretary General of the EFF more than two times, pursuant to them voting with the opposition to remove President Zuma. So it's something he's owned up to. And in fact, the senior leadership structure of the African National Congress is meeting this weekend following these revelations. And part of what's expected to be on the agenda, this revelation by Derek Hanekamp and his admission of it.
Does this revelation really tarnish the image of the ANC?
The reality of the matter is that at the time that these activities were done, there was already a huge loss of confidence of the public on the African National Congress. to the extent that if there were attempts to remove Zuma, who was seen to be the driver of this loss of confidence by the voters on the ANC, because remember, his popularity rating at the time had dropped to about 20%. So if anything, the coming out back in the time of the idea that there were some within the leadership structures of the ANC that wanted to remove the then president, that came actually as positive, because the president had been alleged to be involved in state capture, a system in which government resources were being repurposed to serve private interests. So what this does now is actually rattling feathers within the ANC, but is not necessarily affecting the support in the ANC, but it serves to strengthen the perception that the governing party is highly divided and is at war with itself.
Former President Zuma also threatened that he was going to expose some people who were double agents in his cabinet following these revelations. What do you make of it?
President Zuma exploits narratives of betrayal and selling out in order to defend an indefensible time in our history when he was directly responsible for undermining the African National Congress as the governing party, as he went on to reshuffle ministers at will, and reshuffling ministers who were not doing the bidding of the private interests which he favored, the Guptas. So when he said that in the testimony that he gave before the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture, it was an attempt to deflect attention from the subsequent failure by him to answer to specific things about how he had used his influence to favor his colleagues.
Omgama Mtika is a political science professor at the Nelson Mandela University. He spoke with me from Port Elizabeth, South Africa. The Gambian Press Union is demanding justice for the murder of journalists killed during former President Yahya Jammeh's regime. Sherif Bojang Jr., president of the group, says dedicated journalists who disclose the activities of the Jammeh government were subjected to gross human rights violations and in some instances killed. His remarks came after a former army officer confessed to being part of the 2004 murder of Deda Haidara, editor and co-founder of The Point Daily, a major independent newspaper. For more reaction to the confession, I reached Sherif Bojang Jr., president of the Gambian Press Union.
A lot of people are shocked by these confessions. I mean, generally, there have been a lot of rumors, there have been a lot of insinuations and speculations as to how Deda was killed and the motive behind his killing. But what people knew and what a lot of people suspected deeply was that the government had a hand in it. And what people didn't know is that somebody someday would come and sit in front of a group of people and be watched or listened to by Gambians, both at home and in the diaspora, to say that he took part in that brutal killing of Deda Haidara, and that the president, Yahya Jammeh, instructed that killing and asked them to go and kill him in an operation described or named as the Golden Pen in reference to Deda. You know, there is a lot of anxiety in the country, especially among the media, as to how that could happen to somebody who dedicated his life to the advancement of democracy and media freedom in the country.
The former president denied ordering the killing of Deda Haidara, basically saying that the state had no hand in the killing, specifically explaining that perhaps Deda Haidara's love life might have caused his death because he was in the company of two females during his murder. How do you react to that?
From the moment Jammeh mentioned that, that incident, the Jammeh statement, that very rude and arrogant and heartless and insensitive statement from Jammeh at the time, you know, resulted to a group of journalists, you know, being convicted and being sent to jail because they issued a statement on them, you know, Jammeh's insensitive and unfounded statement accusing Data or making Gambians believe that Data might be killed, you know, because of a love affair or something. Possibly the two women that were, you know, in a vehicle with Data when he was shot, where he stopped, and he was taking his staff home, you know, after the 13th anniversary of the Point, his newspaper. So Jammeh all along reacting to Data's murder, exonerating himself and his government, was that, I quote, "My soldiers didn't shoot Data because they wouldn't have missed the two women who were my soldiers, would never shoot and miss anybody." So the fact that the two ladies didn't die, according to him, you know, manifested that his soldiers didn't have any hand in it.
The supporters of the former president are saying that the allegations being made by former soldier Jatta is neither here nor there, and that they believe former President Jammeh of not being involved in this because he did not supply the weapons that were used. He did not give the order. He did not give monies to these people, because these are mere allegations that does not provide empirical proof implicating the former president. What is your response to that?
Have had former supporters of the former president on the social media saying, oh, this is not true. But let's look at it. The people who have been coming out, especially the past 1 week, that have been coming out to confess to these crimes, were more loyal to the former president than any political supporter could possibly be. They were hired for many years, some of them more than 10 years, just to be killing people, to be tormenting people, to torture people in the name of loyalty to the president, directly under the command of the president and under the authority of the president. And these are people who benefited, financial or otherwise, from the former president. They have no reason to sit there and lie. And you can see every single story, every testimony, every confession, they all match. You can corroborate, you can see the resemblance, and it's so consistent, you know, what happened, the pattern of abuse, the pattern of killing of, I mean, Data Hydra and other Gambians.
Some people are saying the hearings are the TRRC is encouraging people to demand former President Yahya Jammeh should be extradited to face the TRRC or be prosecuted for the alleged crimes committed during his reign. What is the stance of the Gambia Press Union?
Well, we always ask for justice. We're still demanding justice for the killing of Data Hydra, state-sponsored disappearance of journalist Chief Ibrahim Amani, and of course his death. We also been demanding for justice for journalists, a host, a lot of journalists who were tortured, who were cut with bayonets, who were held incommunicado, had electricity, you know, put on their genitals, who were cut everywhere and stuff. And our hope and our demand is that he stand trial.
Sherif Bojang Jr. is the president of the Gambian Press Union. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. Ugandan opposition parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi says he will challenge incumbent and longtime President Yoweri Museveni in the 2021 general election. The lawmaker who leads the People Power Movement is a musician popularly known as Bobby Wine. Meanwhile, other opposition groups, including the newly formed Alliance for National Transformation, or ANT party, plans to work with Bobby Wine ahead of the election. For more about the new party's decision to work with Bobby Wine, I reach Alice Alasso, General Secretary for the ANT.
We are okay, we are happy with anybody in Uganda who initiates attempts to cause a political change in this country. So we actually wish him well in his endeavors, and we hope that it will bear fruit in whichever way.
Will your party work with him in his plan to challenge President Museveni in the next election? Will you work with him?
We are working with all other stakeholders, not only the People Power. We have expressed our willingness to be part of a greater coalition, the Democratic Party, all those parties and forces in the opposition and individuals, including People Power. We are comfortable working with them to build synergy towards a political change in this country. Our partnership with them will then be defined when we get to that point. We will sit for a discussion and say what are the conditions, who is going to be the candidate, how are we going to partner in constituencies. That is something that will be worked on. But in principle, we are working with all other stakeholders including People Power, who are interested in seeing a regime change in Kampala and Uganda.
So most people wonder why there is no coalition or alliance at the moment to go around to campaign in anticipation of the next election, particularly when you know the dominance of the NRM. People are wondering, why wouldn't the opposition team up, since you have one objective and one objective only, to wrestle power from President Yoweri Museveni?
It has to be a deliberate effort. It's actually easier said than done. It will require building strength and capacity from the grassroots. As a political party right now, what we are doing is to put in place our leadership, our committees, our coordination mechanisms all over the country. And that is the stage, if I followed yesterday very well, that is the very stage Bobi Wine is in. He's also putting together a coordination team. And it looks to me that many other political parties, the Democratic Party, has also been working towards the uniting its team to build that capacity. Until you have reached that necessary strength, it is not wise to begin discussing a presidential candidate at the top when you don't know what delivery mechanism is required to bring out that presidential candidate.
Some critics of the government are saying that your association with Bobi Wine could cost you because you could politically be stifled, or which they accuse sometimes of using state institutions to harass and intimidate opponents. Are you ready for that, based on your declaration of working with Bobi Wine and other opposition groups?
It's not the first time that it's going to happen. We are not new in the political scene. We've gone through that before. There are certainly is a backlash against the opposition. Even now, without reaching a time when the campaigns have been, when the official calendar for campaigns has started, there is already difficult terrain here. Opposition politicians do not find it easy and are denied access to hold rallies. Even town hall meetings, we have to write letters to the police just to allow us to use a boardroom. And all manner of restrictions, people are switched off from radio stations. So it has been like that all along. And the internet gets worse during a general election season. But that should not discourage anybody. It is our commitment to be part and parcel of the change agents in this country until it reaches a logical conclusion. So we are committed to work, and I imagine the other people also are committed to do their part.
Alisa Lasso is the General Secretary for the Ugandan Opposition Party, ANT. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The UN Refugee Agency says up to 150 refugees and migrants are believed to have lost their lives Thursday in a shipwreck on the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Libya. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says close to 140 survivors, mainly Eritreans and Sudanese, were pulled from the water, including women and children. If the toll of 150 lives lost is confirmed, the UNHCR says it will be the biggest shipwreck on the Mediterranean Sea since May 2017, when 156 people died off the coast of the Libyan capital, Tripoli. UNHCR spokesman Charlie Yaxley says the latest tragedy comes weeks after more than 50 people were killed when their detention center in Tajura on the outskirts of Tripoli was hit in an airstrike.
In addition to the shipwreck yesterday, a further 87 people were brought back to Libya by the Libyan Coast Guard, and 84 of them were transferred to Tajura. So the total population in Tajura now numbers nearly 300. And this is completely unacceptable, and we call for their immediate orderly release.
There were no search and rescue boats operated by non-governmental organizations in the sea Thursday when the migrant boat ran into trouble. That is because hardline governments such as Italy are prohibiting them from conducting these life-saving missions. Yaxley says their crucial role must be acknowledged and their efforts in saving lives must not be stigmatized nor criminalized.
There also must now be a return of EU state search and rescue vessels to the Mediterranean. And we reiterate once again that no return of refugees and people rescued on the Mediterranean should be to Libya, as it has no port of safety.
The UNHCR is calling for more action to arrest and prosecute smugglers and traffickers who profit from people's desperation by facilitating their doomed voyages. It says they must not be allowed to act with impunity and be held accountable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, there's a visible infrastructure boom in the Kenyan western city of Kisumu. Analysts attribute the development to the government's effort to boost regional trade and infrastructure. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached Fred Omulo, a Kenyan journalist in Kisumu, to find out what developments are taking place.
The biggest thing happening here is the development of the lakefront. The lakefront and the associated ports that used to be in use until the collapse of the East African community, when things just started deteriorating and the facility was basically allowed to rot and to decay. So with the development of the Standard Gauge Railway, which came from the port of Mombasa down in the Indian Ocean, the Standard Gauge Railway is 100 to 150 kilometers away from Kisumu, and it's headed in this direction. Now, that has a lot of trade and business implications for the East African community, specifically Tanzania and Uganda, who are the other countries that border the lake. So a lot of activity has been going on there. They've been expanding the berth, expanding the shipping routes, and trying to see how they can deal with the hyacinth problem on Lake Victoria. So these and other activities to develop the lake transportation conduits are happening.
This, I think, is going on as a result of the Kenya's interest to boost regional trade and infrastructure development. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. There's been, over the last year especially, there's been incredible interest in infrastructural development for that particular channel. And the president recently handed the Uganda a portion of land within Kenya in a place called Naivasha, where the Standard Gauge Railway has already reached, where it terminates at this moment. And Rwanda and Uganda got large portions to build a dry port, so their goods do not have to undergo a lot of scrutiny at the coast. As long as they are marked destined for Rwanda, destined for Uganda, they can come and be cleared and processed at that particular spot. So it's a huge effort to boost intra-East African trade between the countries here.
And also we understand the relations between President Uhuru Kenyatta and Magufuli are thawing, and is this all in the aim of boosting the, what you refer to as intra-East African region trade?
Yeah, there was in 2015, I think, President Magufuli had a really cold relationship with the whole Kenyan government, and he took a lot of measures to ensure that he favored or he fostered trade within his country or protected his country from Kenyan competition. At some point, they were even almost locking the border post, the Sirare border post here in between Kenya and Tanzania, which is one of the busiest, apart from the other one down at Kwale County. So over the last few months, there's been an about turn, and it's been credited really to the foreign minister foreign minister currently is called Monica Juma. And apparently she's developed a very healthy relationship with the Tanzanian government. And that is also being is being evidenced in improved relationships as far as trade is concerned. The complaints that Magufuli had have been ironed out. The goods that he wanted to stop from being imported into Tanzania, they've defined new categories, and the goods that he didn't want to export from Tanzania into Kenya have also been redefined. So a lot of work is also going on in that direction as well.
Fred Omulo is a Kenyan journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kisumu. Crown Women Rising, a training, networking and empowerment organization, recently held its annual Women's Empowerment and Business-to-Business press launch in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Officials say the press launch focused on empowering women by providing participants with new opportunities. They say the organization also identifies, nurtures and honors high-achieving women globally who promote business growth and community transformation. To learn more about the organization, Emily Soroko, founder of Crown Women Rising, joins me live in the studio. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Peter.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Now, talk to me about Crown Women Rising and what the organization does, apart from what I've enumerated.
So Crown Women Rising is an organization, just as you say, that promotes women economic development globally. But right now we are having a focus on Africa, and we promote the women. We identify the women who are business women. We equip emerging women, and we use training, microfinancing principles, and comprehensive networking and connecting them to local, regional, and international markets.
So far, what has been the impact that you've realized, if I may ask you?
So the African woman is very innovative, very creative, and what has been lacking on the continent is just the platform. Mm-hmm. She needs a global platform where she can showcase her products. And that's one of the things that Crown Women is really striving to do, just giving the women on the continent that platform.
So what motivated you to establish this Crown Women Rising initiative?
So the inspiration is that I grew up in an environment of very economically empowered women, mm-hmm. My grandmother and my mother. And my grandmother was an entrepreneur, and she was the backbone of the family. And what she did was really embark on education. And the reason we are so focused on education is that women in Africa, if they're not educated, you see a lot of young women married in marriages. So we are trying to avoid the young marriages. We are also trying to avoid the young pregnancies, which really impact the life of women. If they are pregnant at 15 years or married at 15 years, then they are completely cut off the economic empowerment path. And then we see these children being raised by these young women, ending up to be in the streets and doing all sorts of crazy things. So this is the biggest inspiration to really eradicate these young marriages, and also to get these women to be the backbone of their families. Just like my grandmother, if you educate a woman, it changes everything in the family. We find that children get educated, they are able to partake in the economic development, they are able to do things that they should be doing for their family. So my grandmother was big on education, and she said that if you are educated, you can become whatever you want to become. Mm. You can live where you want to live. Now I live in the United States. So she had a local impact in the family, in our community, and now we are going global just because of one woman.
Absolutely. So those women who have come into contact with this organization, mm-hmm. Tell me about the transformation, some of the things you've seen, their progress so far after coming into this organization, after organization, interacted with them and helped them with partnerships, with experts, and with networking opportunities.
So when we get them and they are able to sometimes even network within themselves, they are able to learn new things, new ways of doing things, new ways of selling their products. A lot of things. One woman we had an interaction with in Kenya, we gave her an award because she was already empowering other women. That's one of the things we do. We award women who are high achievers because we are looking for the stories to empower other women. And she got so much confidence. She started going around the whole country in Nairobi speaking, flying for the first time on Kenya Airways. And recently she got married.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and that also, we are looking at the family dynamics. Mm-hmm. What happens to when this woman is empowered? She's able to raise her own family. I mean, putting food on the table, sending them to school. And also now she becomes a forceful power in the community.
Mm. So what do you think are the prospects of the Crown Women Rising organization?
So the Crown Women Rising has goals that we would like to not only empower women in the communities, we would like to take them from the communities. In Kenya, we call them the mama mbogas.
Mm-hmm.
Take them from the mama mbogas to the supermarkets and eventually to Target, Walmart, global markets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what our long-term goal is, that we find these women where they are and really take them to the next highest level.
You definitely will need partnership and sponsors for what you do. Talk to me about ways by which business organizations can help achieve this objective that Crown Women Rising is trying to espouse here.
Yeah, so we are having a lot of upcoming events. We're going to be in Accra, Ghana, September 4 and 5, in Nairobi, November 1st and 2nd, and eventually we are going to New Delhi. What we are looking for is people who are so passionate about getting these women into these global markets, empowering women economically for all the reasons I've given, and really partnering with us by going to our website, www.crownwomenrising.org, and really coming alongside us and helping us to do what we are trying to do. We all know how important it is to really economically empower women.
Mm. Talking about businesses that sometimes women head, some suggest that they could help your organization since it has a global reach, although focusing on Africa right now.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think other organizations can do to help you actualize the dream and objective of Crown Women Rising in terms of partnerships, in terms of sponsorship? I'm talking about both profit and non-profit organizations to partner the organization here.
Yeah, so some of the big organizations in America have really good training modules that are online,
mm-hmm.
or they can come to different countries in Africa and train. So we are looking for some of those organizations that can do that. We also have a lot of big companies on the continent that can come and help us with the sponsorship, with the money that we need to do the conferences, to do the training. So we are welcoming all those companies. We are also welcoming people who can come and help us execute the event. There are people in America who are maybe retired, very young, with a lot of energy. If they want to go out there and help us, they just come to our website and send us an email and we'll be happy to partner. So all those are different ways of partnering with us.
Are governments allowed to partner with Crown Women Rising? Because a lot of African countries sometimes have policies towards women. Can they be brought in to help support this initiative?
Yeah, we work with governments. We are working with also international organization, USAID, using their AGOA model. So we welcome the governments in any country we work with. We are reaching out to them ourselves, and now they can reach out to us, and together we can really be able to help these women.
Mm. Talk to me about your expectations for the upcoming events of the Crown Women Rising, right from Accra to Kenya, Nairobi, and then to New Delhi that you spoke about. Your expectations for these
anticipated programs?
We are anticipating seeing a lot of women who are in business come out and showcase their products. The first thing we do is when we have the summit, we have the training part of it, we have the forum, but also we have the expo where women actually bring their products so we can see what they're doing. And we have experts who can look at them and see if they are export ready. And then from there, now we create the models that we need for training.
Before we go, your final message for the people listening to you about Crown Women Rising Initiative.
So the final message to me is that when we empower a woman, whether it's economically or any other way, we are really helping a family. The family is the backbone for the community and for the country. So you see that if we raise strong families, we have strong governments with less corruption, with less poverty, and really our... My biggest inspiration for Crown Women is to see less poverty on the continent.
Thank you very much. Emily Soroko is the founder of Crown Women Rising. She spoke with me from the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You are hearing Mafi Kizolo featuring Diamond Platnumz and DJ Maforiza with Colors of Africa. Ms. V comes next with I Don't Know, and then Kanda Bongo Man with A Sambi.
We'll be right back.
that was Music from the Continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team. Managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, speak softly and carry a big stick, you will go far. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.